happening on Sunday, September 14th at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. We're accepting donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, VHS, and cassette tapes, and all donations are tax deductible. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit your community radio station, KBOO. So bring those donations down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. For more information, please contact Jesse, 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. That's the annual book and record sale on Sunday, September 14th.
What a life. 210 days of school until next vacation.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Washington Gorge Action Program's Back to School fundraiser August 23rd from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Columbia Gorge Interpretive Center, 990 Rock Creek Drive in Stevenson, Washington. There will be a fashion show, live music, a silent auction, and dessert social. Washington Gorge Action Programs is a multi-purpose human service organization dedicated to helping individuals, families, and communities address basic human needs. Again, that's the Washington Gorge Action Programs Back to School fundraiser, August 23rd at the Columbia Gorge Interpretive Center, 990 Rock Creek Drive in Stevenson, Washington. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fograng, and the show is Fight the Empire. And you're really a distinguished guest today, James Kunstler, who's written a lot of books, Long Emergency, Too Much Magic, which are nonfiction books. But then he's got a series, The World Made by Hands series. And the latest one is coming out very, very soon, is A History of the Future. So, James Kunstler, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Per.
Well, how you doing?
By the way, that book is out.
It is out now. Oh, I thought, okay.
It's a novel.
Yes, it is. It's about the, well, set the scene for us. You describe a future that's kind of a little too close for comfort, so set the scene.
This is the third in a series of four novels that I'll write all together, one for each of the four seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's set in the post petroleum American future, the post-economic collapse American future. It's set in a small town in upstate New York. The first book was called World Made by Hand. The second one was called The Witch of Hebron. The third one, which takes place around Christmas time, is titled A History of the Future. And in this one, the story kind of opens up, and one of the characters has gone off to see what happened in the heartland of America.
Well, and you have these continuing cast of characters who are really very interesting. And this town of Union Grove, I mean, there's the world is, well, it is a world made by hand. And people survive in some ways. They live very well. They seem to eat pretty well. You describe some very nice meals and kind of smorgasbords and things like that. And they... There's different ways of making a living from the land.
Well, I'm describing an economy which has become centered on agriculture and the activities that support farming and the activities that come out of it, you know, making things out of the products that you produce locally. I'm not trying to be didactic in this book. These books really are intended to have a lot of dramatic velocity.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that you refer to, that, the The economy is basically a farming economy. You know, we've left behind the techno-industrial fiesta, and folks are living a lot more like 1830 than 2014.
Well, like one of the characters is Stephen Bullock, who sort of runs a feudal manor, and it functions very well. You know, he's got all these different people living there, and they sort of form a kind of a village. They're kind of a self-contained economy. It's interesting. I found it interesting that over the three novels, Stephen Bullock seems to be turning out to be not so nice a guy, kind of a nasty guy.
Well, he's getting a little frayed around the edges from his duties and responsibilities and obligations. You know, what I'm trying to portray with some of these farmer characters is that, you know, the whole idea of creating this farm economy or having it emerge from the wreckage of the industrial economy is that, we haven't really settled on a way that this is done, and so they're all doing their farms somewhat differently. Mr. Bullock has sort of settled on an operation that's like a feudal village, and he's invited people whose professions and vocations have disappeared to come and live on his property and to work there. And you know, he provides shelter, food, and security for them, and a kind of an armature for daily life that you know, allows people to live comfortably. But at the same time, they've basically sold their allegiance to him, and he gets to determine everything that goes on there. In this book, he's faced with the problem of one of the people living in his plantation, as they call it, has misbehaved and injured a horse, and injured it pretty badly, and on purpose, because it stepped on his foot. And he's going to be tossed off the property, and that becomes one of the big issues. Some of the other farmers, you know, run their operation differently. They employ the people who live in the village, who go to work every day, like, you know, working people, and live in the village. So there are different models for how farming might, you know, work itself out in the future. But these are all kind of subsidiary to the story itself, or the stories, because it's kind of a woven fabric of dramatic threads.
Well, then there's this other group, Brother Job and his New Faith community, kind of a, you know, in the first book, he's sort of almost like a kind of a fun character, but he seems to be, I don't know, growing in stature in some ways. Am I wrong?
Well, he wasn't really held up to ridicule in the first one. He's a complicated character. You know, he's kind of a combination of Boss Hogg and Captain Ahab. You know, there are elements of him that are comical, and there are elements of him that are rather dark. His group, which is sort of a Christian cult, has migrated up to upstate New York to escape the disorders of Dixieland, because I portray the South as being a very disorderly place in the near American future. And in this new book, which I think I may have mentioned, it is already out. It is in the stores and at the usual venues for buying books. In this new book, at the center of it is the journey of young Daniel Earle to the center of the country, where he comes to the Foxfire Republic, as it calls itself. It's a breakaway white supremacist republic formed of Tennessee, Kentucky, the Carolinas, Virginia, West Virginia, Missouri, and Arkansas. And this breakaway republic is run by a former country singer and TV evangelist, a lady named Loving Morrow, who I like to think of as Dolly Parton meets Hitler. And so we get a glimpse of what has happened. You know, this is sort of the teabagger breakaway republic, sort of. And we get a glimpse of what's going on in the USA.
Well, actually, a foxfire, some kind of a fungus that glows in the dark, does that mean anything?
Yeah, sort of is. But it's also, you know, it has sort of associations with Southern folklore. Not all of them terrible. I mean, it's a kind of a sweet, lovely image. But the Foxfire Republic is kind of a disturbing case of a political outcome that I would think we would want to avoid. But who knows? You know, I'm trying to dramatize a plausible future. You know, the great thing about writing fiction, and I've written both many books of nonfiction and fiction, the great thing about fiction is that you don't have to be correct. You just have to be plausible.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also a couple other. There is sort of a reconstituted United States, which is now up in Huron, Michigan. Is that where the Port Huron statement came from?
I actually don't. I'm not quite sure. I think Port Huron came from Port Huron, but I have depicted the capital of the remnant of the Federal Republic having moved to a small town on the shores of Lake Huron in upper not upper Michigan, but in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And in the stories, in all of the stories in the background, we know that there have been two catastrophic bombings in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., and that has made it necessary for the government to move around. And so it's, for a while it was in Chicago, for a while it was in Minneapolis, and now it's moved to this rather remote but defensible village on the Great Lakes, which is being outfitted for the government, specifically for this government, which is a much reduced version of the federal government of our time.
But they still have a kind of a CIA and special operations and all that stuff, which is sort of, they call it the continuity in government. I guess that's what it's all about.
Well, the remnant of the federal government depicted in A History of the Future is pretty much led by the former elements from the CIA and the Department of Defense and Homeland Security, and they've kind of all concentrated into one group. Because most of the government has been killed in the Washington bombing, as depicted in the novel.
Well, let's talk about this, you know, the great calamity that overtook the United States. Would you say it's was peak oil the main cause, or is that just one of several?
You know, in all of these books, I've never actually specified how this collapse occurred, but I think anybody could infer from the clues that I drop and of course, from the nonfiction books that I've written before this this series of books, and those were The Long Emergency and Too Much Magic, which actually I wrote between novels.
Mm-hmm.
And in those books, you know, I was very concerned with several things. The peak oil story, which Americans have been propagandized into thinking is no longer a problem, but it is very much a problem, and I think we're going to discover to great disappointment that shale oil will not allow us to drive to Walmart forever. In fact, I'd flatly predict that we're going to see shale oil turn around and start to decline substantially by 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Probably by the fall of 2015.
That seems to be. The reason is that these wells deplete very, very quickly, so you have to keep drilling more and more and more.
That's true. They deplete very quickly, and the capital, I don't think, is going to be available to do that because shale oil does not make any money.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been performing these operations on huge amounts of borrowed money for the last 7 years or so, and they're going to run out of the ability to do that. You know, I think that for readers to understand the oil situation is not all that difficult. And let me try to explain how it works, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the old days, you had a Texas oil well that cost about $400,000 in today's money to drill and produce thousands of barrels a day for decades. So it was a real good investment. It produced a great payoff in terms of the available energy compared to what you had to put into it. So $400,000 for the well produced thousands of barrels a day for decades, as compared to shale oil, which costs between $6 to $12 million in today's money per well and produces maybe 110 barrels a day, maybe for a year, and then it starts depleting down by half, and then in 3 years it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can just see the amount of investment and drilling and capital and money and energy and time that's going into the production of shale oil to see that it's not a very good bargain. And, you know, the reason I wrote my previous nonfiction book, Too Much Magic, which was subtitled Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. The reason I wrote that was because it was obvious to me around 2008, 2010, that America had entered into a mood of tremendous wishful thinking, trying to persuade itself that we could drive to Walmart forever and that we wouldn't have any problems running suburbia and that everything that we had invested in was, going to be okay, including, all those suburban houses and, all the infrastructure and et cetera. We don't like to think that we're going to have to change our behavior pretty drastically. And so we've been telling ourselves for several years that it's all going to be all right. Unfortunately, that's a fairy tale. You know, I think that we're going to discover probably in fairly short order that this is not true.
Well, we're talking with James Kunstler about his latest book, A History of the Future, which is third in the World Made by Hand series. Tell me, do you think that our leaders, are they delusional, or are they aware of what's going on and they're kind of, I don't know what, scamming us in some way?
And, I think that we all wonder that. We all wonder, for example, does President Obama or does the Secretary of Energy really understand the dynamic of shale oil and shale gas? It's hard to tell. Mr. Obama declared in 2011 that we have 100 years of shale gas. That's just not true. I don't know who told him that. I suppose, among others, his Secretary of Energy. And if they do believe those kinds of things, then they've been hosed pretty badly by the oil industry's PR department. And, it would speak pretty badly for our leadership. But it's hard to tell. It may be more a matter of this being a story that they just can't bear to tell the public, that it's just mm-hmm. too difficult. So,
well,
that, we can certainly tell from the behavior of the government and of some of the institutions that serve it, like the Federal Reserve, which is not, strictly speaking, a part of the government, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a private institution. But we can tell from the behavior of these institutions that, they're pretty scared, especially all the things involved with finance, because the financial system is probably the most fragile of all the complex systems that we depend on for daily life. And if it cracks up, a lot of the other systems are not going to work, namely agriculture, transport, industrial production, et cetera. So, I keep my eyes on the financial system to see, where the possible fault lines are.
Well, what are some of those? Let's go into a little detail here. I mean, if the financial system collapses, a lot of things go down with it. So how would this play out in sort of daily life?
Well, I think the best way to understand it is that we went through this 200-year-long industrial orgy in which we produced a tremendous amount of wealth. And in order to enable that to happen, or, let's say, in an emergent way that a system self-organizes itself, the financial system self-organized itself to serve the industrial orgy that we went through. And in the process became extremely complex. And a lot of these complexities surrounded the whole issue of creating debt and being able to pay it back. And when you're on the upswing in an industrial society, you can create a lot of debt because there's always the expectation that there will be more of everything. There will be more wealth produced. There will be more goods produced. There will be more infrastructure, et cetera. So that basic dynamic drives the belief that we can continue to lend money to ourselves indefinitely and be able to service the cost of it, which is, you know, expressed in interest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's happened is that because of the end of cheap oil around 2005 and the beginning of the very expensive oil part of the oil era, we no longer have that assurance that we're going to have more of everything because our energy costs are now so high and the inability to grow the energy supply is now such a problem for the world. And the effect of the high prices on industrial economies is so severe that we no longer have the faith that we can pay off our future debts. And that has thrown the whole banking and interest system into disarray. And we've been trying to offset that and compensate for it for the last 7 years or so by juking the system, by creating a lot of fake wealth and creating a lot of paper and digital financial instruments that pretend to have value but don't have value, and playing games and conducting shenanigans with markets and finance. And there have been many repercussions of that. You know, one of them is that obviously we are suffering from capital the impairment of capital formation. That is, we cannot produce and marshal new wealth for investment in more productive stuff. It's becoming very difficult. Another problem is that we've distorted the markets terribly. And mainly what we've done is that we've disabled the price discovery mechanism of markets. And what that fancy term means is markets exist in order to determine the prices of things, the value of things, so that you know what things cost and what they're worth and what you can trade them for, etc. And the policies of the government and of the Federal Reserve have so distorted the markets, especially by imposing a policy of 0% interest rates, that the cost of everything has been distorted and perverted, and we can't really tell what the true value of things really are, whether they're stocks or suburban houses or gold coins or anything. So right now we're sort of struggling through this fog of distorted markets, but I think we'll move at some point into a state of greater criticality with the banking system itself.
So I guess if debts don't get paid, you have a chain of defaults, and how does that play out?
Well, what happens is money disappears in mm-hmm. a deflationary depression.
Mm-hmm.
When people cannot pay back old debts and they cannot take on new debts and the system cannot generate new credit, you end up with a system that in which money basically disappears. You know, there are kind of two ways of going broke with money, where the management of money is concerned. One way is deflation, where money becomes scarce and nobody has any money, and you're broke. And the other way is inflation, where the people who generate the money or print the money or make it appear in computers create so much of it that it loses its value. And then everybody has plenty of money, but it's worthless money. It's mm-hmm. not worth anything. So you know, you can have a wheelbarrow full of money, but you can't buy anything with it. So two ways of going broke, deflation or inflation.
Wow.
What's likely to happen in our case is that we'll go through a deflationary phase first as it becomes evident that the debts can't be paid back. And then the reaction to that will be exorbitant money printing, even beyond what we're doing now, and that will throw the society into a severe inflation, and then people will have plenty of money, and it won't be worth anything.
Well, in the book, you write about techno grandiosities coming to a sudden end. What are they? Does that include the internet or all the games they have these days, or what?
I created these kind of handles for referring to our relationship to technology. And one that I use a lot is techno-narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean, you know, we're just too infatuated with the technological tricks that we've been able to pull off so far, and we don't understand a number of things about them. We don't understand, for example, the blowback or the diminishing returns or the consequences of these things. And, you know, a very good example of that is what happened to the telephone system. You know, we had a hardwired landline system for about, I don't know, 100 years. And then we computerized the whole phone system, and we created a lot of, interesting things, cell phones that could take pictures and, you know, read the stock quotes and get the news flashes and stuff and send messages to your friends. But at the same time, the computerization of the phone has led to a situation where you can't call any number in the USA and get a live human being.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no longer possible to talk to people over the phone, especially in business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you call any business in America, you will get a robot.
Right.
And it is, you know, it's incredibly dismaying, even if it's a good system. And most of them are not good systems. Most of them are terrible systems that in one way or another waste your time and make you feel helpless and destroy whatever transaction it was that you were trying to do. But, we're not figuring any of these things in. So our techno-narcissism involves that, you know, infatuation with technology without any acknowledgement of the repercussions. And the techno-grandiosity is just kind of a description of the basic mindset of that, you know. We just think too highly of our technical abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is we're going to be disappointed by what technology can do for us in terms of rescuing industrial civilization. Destiny is taking us in a certain direction. We don't really want to go there, and we don't even want to think about going there. Mm-hmm. But we're going there, whether we like it or not.
Well, will the cell phone tell you that our soil is rapidly depleting?
It could if you dig deeply enough in Google, perhaps, or, you know, mm-hmm. the U.S. Bureau of Mines or whoever reports that, the Department of Agriculture. You could learn that. You'd probably have to go through quite a struggle to learn it, but it's not going to announce it to you. No, you're going to be sitting there doing Facebook on your phone, you know, and telling your friends about what you had for dinner or, who you're sleeping with or whatever. And meanwhile, the soil is washing away in Nebraska and Iowa and Illinois, washing into the Mississippi watershed and flushing out into the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, how long do you think the Internet will be around?
Well, it's a little hard to say. My basic idea is this, is that America seems to be unaware that the Internet depends on a reliable electric system.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the features of American life today is that, you know, unbeknownst to us, sitting at home with all of our stuff working and our TVs working and the computers on, we don't really have a sense of how decrepit the American electric grid is. But it's in very poor shape. Probably take $1 trillion to renovate it, to keep it working just at the level that it's working now for a long period of time.
Oh,
ahead.
Boy.
Well, and we don't want to make those investments.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not thinking about that. So, you know, my guess is that at some point ahead, the electric service will become, at best, irregular mm-hmm. in many places. It'll probably be better in some places than other places. But it won't be on all the time.
Oh,
it
boy.
Won't be 24/7, 365. And then, you know, when that's the case, I think people will find that the Internet is not a reliable system for running a society on.
I wish we had more time. We have to end it on that. Now, you say there's one more novel coming out in this series?
Yeah, I'm writing it now. It's the fourth installment of World Made by Hand.
Mm-hmm.
This one takes place in the spring.
Uh-huh.
The others took place in the summer, Halloween and Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And so the new one that's out is number 3, and it's called A History of the Future.
Oh, boy.
Published by the Atlantic Monthly Press.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. You've been talking to James Kunstler, author of History of the Future. It's a book well worth reading, and I'm sure you can Get it at Powell's or anywhere you buy your books these days. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Pierre. It's always a pleasure.
Well, we'll do it again when the next book comes out, if not sooner.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
KBOO Portland is the station, your community radio station, a Thursday morning, 1 minute before 10 o'clock. Air Cascadia is off today. We'll be heading into Flashpoints momentarily. Coming up in 1 hour, join us for Between the Covers. Today, host Leanne Krantz welcomes Eden Lepucky, author of the debut novel California. At 11:30 today on the Radio Zine, guest Drew Cameron talks about his work with the Combat Paper Project that works directly with communities affected by combat to transform military uniforms into sheets of handmade paper. That's all coming up this morning on The Mighty Boo. A listener called us a while ago to give us this community announcement. Today is National Day of Outrage in response to the events in Ferguson, Missouri. These protests have been organized by the group Anonymous, and there will be protests across the country today, including one in Portland at Pioneer Courthouse Square at 4 o'clock. It is 10 o'clock. Join us next for Flashpoints on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio and the Star Theater are proud to present a special pre-Burning Man mid-tempo dance party and double album release at the Star Theater Thursday, August 21st. For Halo Refuser, it's the release of his full-length album, Into Your Layers. And for Gouda, it's the release of his Tyromancy EP. Also performing, Ninja Monk, Takimba of the Melting Pot Radio Show, with live musicians and fusion belly dance from Bridgetown Review. That's Thursday, August 21st at the Star Theater. For more information, go to the right side of the KBOO webpage under events.